Good evening. It's good to see everybody tonight. I'm glad we all made it out, and we're back here to worship God and study a portion of His Word. I guess I've known you long enough to open up about some stuff. I'm a fan of wrestling. That's not wrestling, it's wrestling. And I don't know how much y'all have ever watched it. The young kids now like this MMA stuff, and it's a little too real, a little too graphic for me. But I've always enjoyed just watching all the guys out there fighting and going at it, you know. Hulk Hogan and Million Dollar Man and Ric Flair, and somebody's got somebody's girlfriend and somebody did something to somebody's shorts, and so we all got to fight it out. And it's always been a joy watching this stuff. Now, a few years ago when I was being a youth minister in Tupelo, we got together a singles group, and we'd get together every Monday. And a lot of people would watch it. Mainly I watched a chef who'd always cook for us. But it was a good reason, a good excuse to get together and have some good fun. A couple years ago, Kyla called me, and she was excited because living in Clinton, Mississippi, that's where the Million Dollar Man, lives. And he was there getting chicken nuggets somewhere. And she was excited. He had just gotten an order of like 30 nuggets, and his son was there, and he'd gotten an order of 30 nuggets. And she was like, "You got to see these guys." And, well, I never made it to go see them, but she was real excited about it. One of the interesting things about watching wrestling is you know it's fake. And you can always tell before it even begins what's going to happen pretty much. Because we got to have a soap opera, and they got to have a reason for you to watch next Monday night. You know how that works. And in tonight's lesson, I want us to talk about that in relation to Christianity. Now, it's tough to make wrestling and Christianity go together. But that's what we're going to talk about tonight in our lesson. Because there's sometimes in Christianity, in our Christian life, we kind of come across a little on the fake side. We assume that when a person obeys the gospel, that they will come to church, their life will work perfect, and we're amazed that anybody ever has a problem or that anybody ever struggles. Sometimes we're even surprised within ourselves that people have problems and people still struggle, even after they've already obeyed the gospel. We look at ourselves and we say, well, why is it that life happens this way? Why is it that these things go on? And why is it that I'm always fighting and wrestling against what I ought to be? Now, notice in the Bible, it tells us that's what's going to happen. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 10 tells us we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against those powers and principalities and against those forces of darkness which are out there. In the passage which was just read a few minutes ago out of Romans 7, we've read there where Paul, in speaking about the law, and as he's going through the book of Romans, Romans 7 is about freedom from the law, he says, "I did not know that covetousness was wrong except the law revealed it to me. But when I read the law and saw what God wanted me to do, I wrestle with myself because there are things within me that make me want to do things I know I shouldn't do." And if that happened to the Apostle Paul, guess what? It's probably going to happen to us. And it's going to be something that we deal with and something that we work with. And that's one of the lessons I want to get across tonight as we look at the life of Jacob, is how we wrestle against ourselves. And we wrestle against God. And we wrestle against the ideal self, what it is that we want to be. Now, it's messy. And as we look through the life of Jacob, we're going to see where it's very messy, because in the first portion of his life where we're going to look, we see where it's wrestling. It's fake. God is in the picture, but he is controlling himself, and he's putting himself where he needs to be. Then we'll see a big event that happens in his life, and we see later where he still will have problems in life, but now that he's wrestled with God and wrestled with himself, he knows how to deal with these problems, and God will see him through those issues that are there. And I hope as we look at the lesson, and we're going to fly through a lot of Genesis, I hope as we look at the lesson, we'll see how you and I are called to wrestle. Yes, we fight against God. Yes, we fight against ourselves. Yes, we fight against the sources of evil, because we have to learn how to humble ourselves and be placed under God's power, God's control. We have to learn how to say no to self and say yes to God. As we begin looking at the early part of the life of Jacob, we see over in Genesis chapter 25 and 26, where Jacob and Esau's mother has them. And as Isaac and Rebekah have a child and they realize that they're pregnant, God tells them, you have twins that are in your womb and they're fighting. And of course, Esau is born first. Esau is red and hairy, if you've ever seen that in a baby. He comes out first, but right after him is there's Jacob. And Jacob, at the very beginning, is fighting already. He's holding on to the heel of Esau, almost like he's grabbing him in the womb, trying to put himself in front, trying to put himself first so that he can be born first. And so Esau, since he's red and hairy, is named Esau, which is that Aramaic form, which means red. And Jacob is named wrestler, or rebel, or fighter, or supplanter, depending on how you look at it. And we see that Jacob lives up to his name. He is always looking for a route to get ahead. He's always looking for a way or a channel where he can pass everybody else and get a little bit further up. And we'll see that for his entire life. A little bit later in that passage, as we look in Genesis 25, 31, we see where Esau grows up very strong and an outdoorsy. He's a hunter. And he goes out, and we see where Jacob is a very indoors, petite kind of guy. But he's a great cook. And we see where Esau goes out, and his daddy loves it when he brings in the deer, when he brings in the venison. And so he goes out and he hunts, and the parents are gone, and he comes home, but he's famished. And he says, I'm about to die from hunger and about to die from thirst. My life is over, I didn't plan ahead, and everything's falling apart. There's Jacob. Jacob is scheming, Jacob is thinking, and Jacob says, well, you know what? I just happened to have made some of this red stew that you really, really love. And I probably could produce that red stew for you so that you're not famished and so that you don't die. Esau's excited. But Jacob says, but you have to give me your birthright. And if you sell me your birthright, then I will give you some of this red porridge, some of this red stew. Esau, not being the smartest guy in the room, says, well, I'm going to die anyway. Give me some good food. You know how you get to a man's heart, right? Through his stomach. He says, give me some good food and I'll do it. And so Esau eats that red stew and Jacob earns the birthright. As we look at that, we see at the very beginning what we have going on with Jacob. Jacob is able to deal with relationships. But I want us to notice how he's dealing with these things. He always sees himself as the smartest guy in the room, and as he goes through these relationships, he says, as he looks at people, well, how can I manipulate this person? How can I change this person to do what I want him to do, to say what I want him to say, to act how I want to act? And he always sees himself as better and greater than everybody else, and he changes Esau and uses Esau for his purposes. His very brother, his very twin brother, he threw aside so that he could get ahead and take over that birthright which was there. Well, that goes on a little bit later as we get to chapter 27, where the time has come because Isaac realizes he'll soon die. Of course, the birthright was the possessions which firstborn child would receive a double portion. And now Jacob has taken that from Esau of the inheritance, and Esau will get one third. But there was also back time a separate part called the blessing. And in the blessing, the oldest son would get a prayer from his father so that he would be blessed by God. Being in this line coming from Abraham and Isaac, you see this would be a very special blessing to get. But of course, the father, Isaac, loves Esau the best. And so, and since he's the firstborn, he's going to give it to Esau. And so as we look at this idea of dealing with authority, we see where Rebekah comes to him and says, listen, I've got a plan. What we need to do is we need to make you look like Esau. Now, this would be a great, great thing to watch. Because here's a man who is big and hairy, and a little guy who is petite and smooth-skinned, and you've got to make one look like the other. Of course, Isaac's blind. Now, you want to know how hairy Esau was. Skins that are covered with fur, and they wrap Jacob in that fur. That's how hairy Esau was. And they get the blood and some of the guts and such so that he smells like Esau. Esau smells like a good guy, doesn't he? And so he goes up there in front of Isaac, and Isaac feels him, and he says, you sure sound like Jacob, but you sure feel like Esau. And so Isaac goes ahead and he blesses Jacob, thinking he's Esau. And as we look at that blessing, which is there in 7, we see where Jen has learned how to manipulate people. He's learned how to manipulate people in relationships. He's learned how to manipulate and destroy everything ahead so that he can be better, so that all things work for the best. Now recognize that he is a nominal God-fearing person. He knows who God is. His parents have raised him to respect God, at least on the outside, but they haven't got to the heart, have they? Because he continually is tweaking things to make it go just his way. Well, Esau finds out, and Esau gets a secondary blessing, learning that his children will be slaves to Jacob, and Esau goes crazy, and so Esau decides he's going to kill Jacob. And so Rebekah decides to send him out of the country, and they go to a cousin named Laban. And so as we look at him dealing with pride at Laban, we go over to chapter 29 and look through chapter 31. And as we look at him here in the book of Genesis, we see where he begins to deal with Laban. The very first person he meets, or among the first people he meets, are his future wives. And this is a wonderful passage to study if you ever enjoy just reading Scripture. Chapter 29 and verse 11, he has the opportunity to see Rachel. And when he first sees Rachel, Rachel is a good-looking woman. I don't know if they had the right perfume back then or the right makeup back then, but she is good-looking. He looks at her, he kisses her, and he just cries. That's how pretty she was. And so he decides, I'm going to get this woman, and I'm going to be with her. Now, you go down to chapter 29 and verse 17, and our texts differ a little bit from the original Hebrew. Depending on what translation you have, it'll say that she was dim or dim-sighted. Other people would say she was hard to see or somewhat blind. Pretty much, it's a literal phrase coming from the Hebrew, which would say that Leah, her looks, if you looked at Leah, your eyes would burn. That's not what you want to hear about a lady, is it? But she was so bad-looking, in a sense, that when you look at her, your eyes would burn. You would not feel good. You would not feel right looking at this lady. And so you can imagine how she felt with her beauty queen sister. Well, we all know it from Bible class, but Jacob comes and he begins to work for Laban. And he makes the promise because of the beautiful Rachel, which is there, and he says, I'll work for you for 7 years so I can marry her. And it says, he says that 7 years is just like a day in order to work. And you see, all of his life, Jacob has tweaked everybody, but guess what? He's met somebody else who's also the smartest guy in the room. And so he gets married, wakes up the next morning, and looks over, and instead of a beautiful bride, he's got the girl that makes your eyes hurt. What do you do now? He leaves the tent, runs out to Laban, and Laban says, well, you know, it's our culture. We have to marry off the older sister, but for 7 more years, you can have the other one. What a deal. Well, he has the opportunity in order to work another 7 years, in order to be able to marry the woman that he loves. And so now he's happy, and now things are good. And Laban, of course, as we go through chapter 30 and 31, makes the deal. Listen, if you continue raising my goats, you know, we will stay together while you're working these years. I'll take the purebred ones, the ones that are solid brown. You take the speckled ones, and everything will be okay. Jacob, being the smartest guy in the room, learns how to breed goats so that every one of them turn out speckled. And Laban gets very angry. They fight with one another because they both have gotten the best side of each other. And now Jacob has to run away. That's the first half of Jacob's life. And what I want us to notice is not that we marry ugly women, because we don't. Not that we work with speckled goats, because we don't. Not that we serve people red porridge. And you may look at that and say, well, that doesn't apply to me at all. Well, take a step back and look. When you're dealing with somebody, whether it be in the home, whether it be in a job site, whether it be at school, are you dealing with them in a way to find advantage for you and disadvantage for them? How often in your relationships do you manipulate people to try to control them, to try to serve and do what you want to do? How often do you look at yourself and say, well, I'm better than that, and I'm better than those people, and I'm better than those people? That's what Jacob's doing. He should know better. He should put himself before God, but we see where he has difficulty in life. Proverbs 16:18 tells us, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before the fall. Well, as these things are going on, we look a little bit later, or earlier, if you will, back to 28, and we see the idea of Bethel. And as we look at Bethel, we see there in chapter 28, here's Jacob, already manipulated Esau, and he's on his way over to Laban, and he is running away because he's about to be killed. And you can imagine the stress he's going under. And of course, he lays down, and the stone is his pillow, and he looks up, and he sees the stairway to heaven. He says he sees that ladder which goes up, and as he looks at the ladder, he sees the angels going back and forth, and the communication going on with God. And many centuries later, we'll read in the book of John, where that is a prophecy of Christ coming to this world. But Jacob sees these things, and he realizes he's in communication with God, and Jesus and God begin to speak to him and give him blessings. And as he's there, he begins to call that place Bethel. Now, when you study in the Hebrew Aramaic, Beth means a mountain. El is a shortened form of God, Elohim. So he's at the mountain of God. And he recognizes that though he's running away and though he's trying to manipulate everybody, he cannot compare to God, because there is God greater, holier, and mightier than he could ever be. And yet after he sees it, he goes and he tries to manipulate Laban. Well, now that he's running away, we'll see where he comes to the place of Peniel. And Peniel in Genesis 32, I think we are, is where he has an opportunity to meet God once again. Because here's a young man who has just run out of everything which he has. He manipulated his brother. He manipulated his father. He manipulated his in-laws. And now that he's running away, he has nowhere to go but back home. And as he goes to Peniel, he gets to an area where he knows that he's on this side of the river and Esau's on this side of the river. And Esau is bigger. Esau is stronger. And there's nothing which Jacob can do to manipulate the situation where he'll be in charge. And he's stuck. He's stuck. He can't make it on his own. Yes, he tries to manipulate. Yes, he tries some things, but he knows it won't work. He sends across some of his goats. And the shepherds are to come to Esau and say, well, this is a gift for you from Jacob. He sends across the camels, and he sends across the other animals as gifts. He sends across the servants as well. And as a last-ditch effort, he sends his wives and all of his children across that river to present themselves to Esau. And he's sitting there on the side of the river looking across to see if there's destruction, because he has given up everything he has except himself, the chief manipulator. And that night, as he's wondering what to do, and as he's struggling trying to decide what to do, a man appears and begins to wrestle Jacob. And throughout the night, he and this man grapple back and forth, each one trying to become greater, each one trying to have advantage over the other. And it never happens. Jacob cannot win. He cannot succeed. And every trick that he tries, he cannot find a way to win. As daylight appears, the angel says, I need to go. Jacob wouldn't let him go. And so the angel touched Jacob on the hip, released that joint so that Jacob would limp for the rest of his life. And as Jacob continued to cling to him, the angel said, what is your name? And Jacob told him his name. And the angel said, your name is now Israel, because you have fought with God and you have prevailed. And Jacob says, well, what is your name? And the angel does not reply. You see, back in this culture and time, the way in which you showed superiority over another person is you could change their name, and you could find out what their name was. And Jacob had it proven to him that he cannot beat God. He cannot manipulate God. that God is in control. Now tonight, as we look at ourselves, and as you and I think about this lesson, that's a question I have for you. Have you and I had that moment where we try to change God and realize we can't? Maybe it's a sickness of a loved one. Maybe it's financial difficulties. Maybe it's a child who's left the faith. There's a myriad of things which attack us, which move us, which change us. And no matter how smart we are, no matter how many possessions we have, no matter how popular we are, no matter what we do, we can't change it. But God's in control. And the day that we recognize that, and the day that we realize that, our Christianity will be different. You see, a lot of people are wrestling. They wear the right clothes, they wear the right things, they show up the right place, and while they may sing the right songs and pray the right prayers, God really isn't in control. And they manipulate relationships because they're still in charge. Yes, they give God a portion of their life, but they're still in charge. Until the day comes when we recognize we're not in charge. And for the rest of Jacob's life, we see a huge change which is there. In chapter 35, he goes back to Bethel. And as he's there at Bethel, once again at the mountain of God where he saw heaven opened up, God repeats that promise to him and lets him know that he will always be with him. Now, that doesn't mean that Christianity gets any easier. And just because you let God be in charge of your life doesn't mean that there will no longer be any troubles in your life. We sure see that in Jacob's life. We go a little bit later to chapter 37, and we see his lost boy, Joseph. And as we look at this lost boy, we find out very quickly, these boys didn't grow up far from the tree. The apple didn't fall far from the tree. Joseph grows up, and he is, as my children would say, talking smack all the time. He's always saying, hey, I just got this dream, and this dream said you're going to serve me. I just got this dream that said even my father and mother are going to serve me. Man, I'm great. Look at this coat which my daddy made for me, and he didn't make for any of y'all. It's one of those things that's always going through. And the brothers hate Joseph. And so they throw him into a well. And as you and I read the actions of Judah and Levi and Simeon, we see that they also are pretty manipulative. Because they sell Joseph off into slavery because rather than kill him, they thought, well, he'll die anyway and we'll get some money out of it. And they kill some of those goats and they dip those goats into that blood and they come back to their daddy and say, man, it's bad. Look what happened. But we've got rid of Joseph. And there's Jacob. The great manipulator has just been manipulated. The one who is in control of every situation has just raised a family which controls him and puts him down. But we see as life goes on, and we skip ahead a little bit, we see that God is with Jacob. And God takes care of Jacob. And there comes a day over in chapter 46 and verse 30 where Jacob has the opportunity once again to meet his son. And he holds his son in his arms after 20, 30 years or so, and he says, let me die because I finally have seen your face. God has held him through, and God has taken care of him. Now, was it easy? Not at all. But God's in charge, and those things will work for good to those who love the Lord. Going a little bit later, we read about the loving wife, Rebecca, and also the lonely wife, Leah. And we go back a little bit, but it's a passage which I really wish we could spend more time on because it's just fascinating seeing the family dynamic here. You see, as we go back to chapter 29, we see where 29:31 tells us that Leah was unloved, but Rachel was barren. And a bit of irony, whether it's given by God or not, the beautiful princess, the prom queen, you might say, could not bear children. But the girl who nobody loved was very fertile. And so Leah's key, at least in her thoughts, her key to make her husband love her was to have children. And while we can recognize and list off all those kids' names, it's fascinating to read what those names mean. The boy named Reuben, his name translates roughly to, maybe now my husband will listen to me. The next son, Simeon, his name translates to, I am not loved. The next son, Levi, as we look at him, says, maybe my husband now will feel attached to me. And as we continue going down, Gad means, I have a troop. I have many sons, so my husband will love me. And we go down each one of those sons, and you begin reading some of Rachel's and Bilhah's and Zilpah's. You begin reading the handmaidens' names there as they go through, and you see how that family is wrestling and that family is fighting. And it's not just Jacob that's fighting with God, but it's also these wonderful ladies as they're going through this. And you see where they're having difficulty back and forth. But as we continue along, we see that God also takes care of this family dynamic. You see, Rachel, the beautiful wife, dies in chapter 35 and verse 20. And Jacob mourns greatly over her and builds a huge monument to her and buys property. Leah doesn't die until much later in chapter 49, 21. But you know what? She's the one that gets to lay by her husband in the grave. Jacob and Leah are buried together. Now, as you and I read that, we see that family dynamic where nobody's happy. Jacob's having difficulty, Rachel's having difficulty, Leah's having difficulty, and while they rage against one another, God blesses them. God gives them children. God gives them time with their husband. God sees them through the episode of their life. Now, was it perfect? Not at all. But God saw it through. And when God is in charge, God took care of all these things. Now notice God's blessing. After many, many years, Jacob is called by a famine to bring himself and his children down to Egypt. And the son who he thought was dead is now in authority, second only to Pharaoh. And as he goes there, we see in chapter 48, verse 11, we see where he holds his son, and he says, not only has God given me an opportunity to see my son again, I now have grandchildren. And he looks at Ephraim and Manasseh, and he is able to bless them, and he is able to be with them, and he's able to make a relationship and give an inheritance to either one. The point I want us to look at here is a point found over in Psalm 37:25. Where David there says, I've been young, but I'm now old. Yet I've never seen the righteous forsaken, nor those who follow after God begging for bread. And the point David's getting across here, and more importantly, the point I want us to get as we look at Jacob, is that God saw him through the most horrific experiences which he could ever have. But God could not really help him until he truly came to grips with the relationship he had with God. Now think about your life. And where do you fit on that scale? Where do you fit on that chart? Are you Jacob or are you Israel? Are you someone who sees yourself as the smartest person in the room, who when you're dealing with relationships, you manipulate them to turn them to your way? Or are you like Israel who trusts in God and looks for the best in every single situation? Do you rail against authority? And though your father may be Isaac, the son of Abraham, do you work and conspire with others to get your way? Or do you submit yourself to authority knowing that they truly represent God? Now we look at that idea of authority representing not only our government, but also the church, also the doctrines which the church espouses. I've had far too many people say, well, you know, a church split might take care of that. Or maybe if we just got a new elder or a new preacher or whatever, maybe we could start doing this or doing that or whatever else it might be. Those are examples of manipulating Jacobs. We need to be Israel, following after God and doing what He wants us to do. What about the source of pride, which is here? When you look at the idea of pride with Jacob, as he is fighting against the master manipulator, Laban, and they're fighting over who's marrying whose daughter, and they're fighting over what's happening with all these goats. And notice with these fights, they don't care about the collateral damage of what's happening to everybody else because they want to be in charge. How about we ourselves? Do you love others enough to humble yourself? Do you love God enough to step back sometimes and let other people have their way? You see, God blesses those who submit. As you and I look in Philippians chapter 2, beginning in verse 5, the writer there says, your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not equate equality with God as something to be grasped, but he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even that death that's on the cross. Therefore God has exalted him and given him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, those in heaven, those on the earth, and those under the earth, to the glory of God the Father. That's down to verse 11. But as you read through Philippians 2, you find out very quickly the way to become great in the kingdom is to humble yourself. Not just before other people, but before God. But that will not happen until you have that wrestling moment with God, that peniel, that time where you recognize God's got to come first. And that's what I invite each one of us to tonight. To recognize in wrestling that we're going to have fights. We're going to have problems within ourselves. As we go back to the passages we studied at the very beginning of the lesson, Ephesians 6 describes the armor that we wear and the battle that we fight. And it's not against Russia or Iran. It's against the principles of darkness. Satan, who walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. We read in Romans 7 where even the Apostle Paul wrestled with himself to put God first. I invite you to go to that wrestling match and to participate. I invite you to recognize the wondrous majesty, power, and justice of God. And I invite you to share in the journey of what it means to put God first and ourselves last. Of what it means to be truly a Christian, bought as a slave with a price. Of what it means to live glorifying our every breath, every thought, and every motive. For his cause. Because that's what we're called to do. Tonight, if the invitation applies to you, if you need to become a New Testament Christian, or if you need the prayers of this congregation, we invite you to come forward as we stand and as we sing.